Suddenly a sound like the blowing of a violent wind came from heaven and filled the whole house where they were sitting. They saw what seemed to be tongues of fire that separated and came to rest on each of them. All of them were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak in other tongues, as the Spirit enabled them. Now there were staying in Jerusalem God-fearing Jews from every nation under heaven. When they heard this sound, a crowd came together in bewilderment, because each one heard them speaking in his own language. Utterly amazed, they asked, "Are not all these men who are speaking Galileans? Then how is it that each of us hears them in his own native language? Parthians, Medes and Elamites, residents of Mesopotamia, Judea and Cappadocia, Pontus and Asia, Phrygia and Pamphylia, Egypt and the parts of Libya near Cyrene, visitors from Rome, both Jews and converts to Judaism, Cretans and Arabs, we hear them declaring the wonders of God in our own tongues." Amazed and perplexed, they asked one another, "What does this mean?" Some, however, made fun of them and said, "They have had too much wine." God bless to us that reading from his word. The great commentator of the last part of the 20th century, William Barclay, wrote a brilliant set of commentaries called the Daily Study Bible. And the Daily Study Bible came out of a situation he had in his first church. It's nice to know sometimes that academics have actually done the work of being in a church. It was in his first church, and he was fresh out of Bible school. And he, Scottish, very well trained, very deep theologian. And he was very excited about his theology. And so for the first few weeks, he would stand in the pulpit, and he would preach really, really good theology. And he would use enormous words like eschatology and soteriology, which I'm sure you're all excited about. And he would talk about whether you were a premillennialist, a postmillennialist, a pre-tribulationist, and all that. And people are still sat there going, And a bit like the Emperor's New Clothes, a lot of people would nod along, like they knew what all of the big words meant. And there was one lady in his congregation who'd started coming, and he was there when she preached with a view, when he preached with a view, and he was like, he said hello to her, and she said hello, and all that sort of stuff. Very nice. Anyway, he came, and after the first 3 or 4 weeks, she stopped coming. And so, as was the culture at that time, you would have gone around the next week just to make sure. You give them 1 week, they might have been ill. But 2 weeks, you go round and you have a chat. Nowadays, we might leave that for a month, but there you go, because you never know. But you go round and you have a chat. So he went round to her and he said, is there a problem? And she was very much, well, no problem. Is there a problem with the fellowship? Has someone been rude to you? No. Has someone upset you? No. Well, what's the problem? Because you were coming faithfully. You were there when I preached with a view. And now after a month, I discover you're not coming anymore. What is it? What's happened? Did you not get on the rota you wanted to get on? What is the problem? And she said, well, to be perfectly honest with you, Pastor, I can't understand a blinking word you're saying. And he sat down after that, and it's good when we get feedback and we actually do something with it. He sat down after that and he said, well, if she doesn't understand it, I'm not doing my job properly. If I've sat there and I've expounded the depths of substitutionary atonement and yet no one knows what that is because I haven't put it in everyday language, then I'm wasting my time and I'm not speaking her language. So what he did was he sat down and he wrote the Daily Study Bible, and his entire premise of his writings was to make sure that it made sense to regular people. To come to church, you do not need a degree in theology. Okay? Now, you're all breathing a sigh of relief now. You don't need a degree in theology. And actually, in actual fact, in order to come to church, all you really need and to be part of a fellowship and give your life to Christ is an understanding that Jesus Christ died for you on a cross, died for your sins and the sins of those that sinned against you, and was raised to life, and you too will be raised to life. You are forgiven, you are set free. You don't need anything else. Now, you might want more, and that's fine. I can take you deeper if you really want to go deeper. But the purpose of the preaching at that particular point was not to go into a lecture on Karl Barth's dogmatics. It was there in order, or to talk about systematic theology or any of that stuff. It was to talk about the fact that Jesus Christ came into the world to set you free from sin. It's a really simple message. And boy, can we make it complicated. At the time, it's a very interesting fact that you've got all of these people could understand the language, understand what the disciples were saying in their home language, in their native language. But what we have to grasp, and I know I've said this to you before, but what we have to grasp with the ancient world is the fact that everyone spoke Greek. Everyone. It was the lingua franca of, to use a Latin phrase, it was the lingua franca of the day. It was what everyone spoke. In the same way, and I know this sounds really arrogant, but the majority of the world speak English. Which is why we're really lazy. And I don't think we are lazy, actually. English is quite a difficult language to learn. But good job we do it from birth, isn't it, really? But actually, we don't need... And so when you... I remember being in school and people saying, oh, well, you need to learn French. Why? Everyone speaks English when I go to France. And you probably ought to learn... And my dad insisted I learn German. I was like, why? I wanted to do art and drama. And I was told I was doing German. As a result, I hated every single minute of German because I wasn't. I also got in trouble with my teacher. That's a different point. But you know, my favourite word in German, der Fluss, means river. Der Fluss. To be honest, I used it in my speaking exam. It wasn't relevant. But I quite like the idea of going Der Fluss and being recorded for it. The point is that we can... I got very grumpy and I really didn't want to do it. But actually, how many times have I actually used German? Well, I've used it just now. But how many times have I actually used German in my everyday? How many times have I used French? Only if I go to France and I really want to be precocious and... I remember we went to Pont Saint-Esprit in the south of France, and I went in, and you know, you go into a tourist information place, well, the first thing you expect a tourist information place to do is speak English, don't you? Because that's kind of, you hope that would be what kind of welcoming. So I went to Pont Saint-Esprit, and I went in, and I was talking to them in really bad schoolboy French, trying to find out about bad bread in the 1950s, okay? Because what happened in Pont Saint-Esprit in the 1950s was that there they had an outbreak of ergotism, and ergo is a mould that grows on rye. And this had got into the rye flour. And you know the French have a love of bread. Well, it takes 1/100th of an ounce to create LSD from ergo. Okay? 1/100th of an ounce. These people were eating 6 to 8 grams of ergo. The whole village went insane. There were people who thought they could fly. There were people who like jumped out of a window, broke their legs and got up and continued walking. It just absolutely... five people died. And to quote the line in the play, because this is why I went, to quote the line in the play, 5 people died and 200 were so badly damaged they could find no rest or happiness. Basically, and so they ended up suing the French government because they provided the flour and they hadn't screened it properly. So I'm stood there and I'm talking to them about, so first of all, I start out walking in and say, oh, bonjour, parlez-vous anglais? Non. So I'm like, oh, okay, fine. So I'm then trying to tell them, Le Pen, oh mon Dieu. And they're like, what? And then they worked out I was actually, and this is where it really annoyed me, that I was actually genuine. They started talking to me in English. I could have thrown stuff at them, but they did actually give me the right information. But the point is that wherever we go, if you can make yourself understood, brilliant. Now, the way generally British people make themselves understood is just shout and point, isn't it? Because that's, if you say it louder, of course they'll understand. But the point is that we need to make sure that we are talking the language of the people we encounter. There is no point talking above them or below them. You need to meet them. That's what helpful evangelism is. It's what apologetics is. I was once asked, what is apologetics? To which I said, it's making people sorry they ever asked you why you're a Christian. But apologetics is about giving a reason. So let me give you a real life example from a long time ago. Someone came to me and they asked me this question. Why does a good God let bad things happen to good people? I was quite young. I was quite inexperienced. What did I do? I gave them a really, really fantastic textbook answer on theodicy. There you go. What's theodicy? The nature of evil and why God allows evil things to happen. And it was brilliant. Oh, I'd have got a first if I'd presented that at university. They'd have gone, Paul, that's amazing. You've really got to grips with it. And the person was really upset. And I'm like, okay. And off they went. Anyway, I decided I'd go and ask for some feedback. I said, what was it? She said, you didn't answer my question. I said, I did answer your question. No, you didn't. Because what I actually wanted to know is why my granddad has been diagnosed with cancer. That's a completely different question. And how often do we answer a question that we haven't been asked? We assume that we know what the person is asking, but we don't actually know what the person is asking. And Jesus, really interestingly, never falls into this trap. He always asks another question. So when you've got a blind man or someone like that, and he says to them, what would you have me do for you? Not, I know how to solve your problem. Not, oh, you're obviously blind. That's the problem. I'll solve that. No, he says, what would you have me do for you? He always asks one more question. And actually, it became a real thing for me. If I've got to always ask one more question. What do you really mean? What are you actually getting at? Because if I don't answer your question, I've actually failed. You walk away, cross, upset, whatever, and you go, oh, well, that isn't really what I wanted. And I went to you because you might have an answer. Another experience from the village, not me, but someone shared with me an experience they'd had with a minister in the past, or at least a person of clergy in the past, where they were asked, will my parents be in heaven? To which they were given a textbook answer. Well, if your parents didn't believe in Jesus Christ, then they're going to hell. Okay, one more question would have helped. One more question would have helped by saying, when did your parents die? What do you mean by this? Just ask him one more question. And you may then have not ended up with someone walking away from the church because the church is heartless and cruel and is sending people to hell. Didn't even ask whether the parents were Christian. The question was, will my parents be in heaven? Obvious question, did they believe in Jesus Christ? Instead of that, jump straight to, sorry, your parents are going to hell. Who feels comforted? None of us. Why? Because we're not speaking that person's language. We're not dealing with the pain. We're not meeting them where they are. My other favourite, and I might have I've said this to you before. I know I've said this to you before, I'm sure. Because it's one of my bugbears. I think we're answering different questions. You know, the atheist question is, do you believe in God? Okay, and the way an atheist would answer that question is to say, well, no, I don't believe in someone who lives in the sky and, you know, sits on a cloud and has a great big white beard. And of course, there is no such thing as a God. It's not the question that I'm actually answering. Because what I mean when I say, do you believe in God? I'm saying, do you believe that a God can do the things that he says he can do? When God says you're forgiven, do you believe that? Do you believe that God will keep his promises to you? Do you believe that? That's what I mean. Do you believe in God? In the same way, so if I said, I don't believe in will, for example, it wouldn't cease, will wouldn't cease to exist. Okay? He wouldn't disappear in a puff of logic. He would still be there. So the answer, do you believe in God? Well, no, I don't. It doesn't actually stop God existing. It's a nonsense answer, actually. It almost doesn't even be worth answering. But if I say I do believe in will, again, it doesn't actually mean he suddenly comes into being. What it means is that I believe that he can do the things that he's been gifted to do. And when a footballer is about to run on the pitch and their manager says, I believe in you, they just want to know that, I know you can do this. So do you believe in God? That's the question. So we need to make sure that we're answering the questions that are being asked and speaking the language that people are speaking. And I think it's fascinating that the first thing that happens once they get their power is they're sent out to go and proclaim the wonders of God so that everybody understands it. Now, as I said, everyone in the ancient world spoke Greek. You couldn't get around. You couldn't work if you didn't understand Greek. In the same way now, everyone speaks English. But it really does prick up your ears when you hear your own dialect or your own language, your mother tongue, as it were. I don't know if you've ever been in a foreign country where everyone's speaking a different language, and then suddenly you hear your language, and you go, I must go speak with that person. Wow, there's someone else like me here. This is for me. And that's fascinating. This is for me. How personal does the message need to become? Every single one of us in this room speaks English. This is for you. Now, I was born in possibly the greatest city on the planet. Fran would agree. Yeah, in Nottingham. Okay? Now, I moved out of Nottingham when I was 3 years old. However, I can pick out a Nottinghamshire accent in a crowd. And if anyone says to me, Ayok Miduk, I know exactly what they're talking about. And I know exactly, where they're from. I could almost give them a postcode. Actually, I'm attracted towards them because that's my native language, as it were. God speaks to us as he needs us to hear, and it's always a personal invitation. He doesn't just give a general, here you go, come to Jesus, it's always a personal invitation. When the Cockney Rhyming Slang Bible first came out, there was quite a bit of controversy as to what on earth do they think they're doing, creating a Cockney Rhyming Slang Bible. Everyone knows that the Bible was handed down in black covers in 1609 from heaven directly to King James. Or 1611 actually. But actually, it was attempting to speak to people that if you were to quote the King James Version of the Bible to them, you may as well quote Shakespeare. Why do children and many adults, why do they not like Shakespeare? They don't like Shakespeare because they don't understand it, because it's not written in their language. I also think people don't like Shakespeare because it's written to be performed, it's not written to be read and dissected and be translated on the opposite page, to be perfectly honest. If I were to perform for you Shakespeare, you'd love it an awful lot more than if you had to read it and take every single word apart and work out what that means, and the fact that Shakespeare's just made up a word because it fitted his rhyming scheme. But we don't like Shakespeare because we don't understand the language. We don't like, a lot of people don't like the authorised version of the Bible because they don't understand the language. There are too many these, thous, and therefores. Found it fascinating. In the last 25 years or so, they decided they were going to update Christmas carols. Okay? I know. I think that's an own goal, but they took out a load of these and thous. I think it's O Come All Ye Faithful. But they left in thither. We too will thither. Yes, I'm forever using the word thither. I could cope with thee and thou, but why have you left in thither? If you're going to change it, change all of it. Don't just change a bit of it. I think that's an insanity, though. I will actually make that point. When people change the words of Christmas carols, when do most people come to church? Christmas. What do they know? They know the traditional words of the Christmas carols. What have we done? Changed them. In an attempt to be inclusive and welcoming, we've just told them to clear off because we've changed the bit that they actually know. I remember sitting in a Christian ethics, or what was it, a Christian ethos meeting, and there were three members of the clergy there, and two of them were arguing over whose version of the Lord's Prayer was better. Am I right, Jan? Yes. Whether what actions to use, seriously, and whether we use Thy Kingdom Come, Thy Will Be Done, or whether we use Your Kingdom Come, or Your Will Be Done, and whether we said debts or trespasses, or whether we said transgressions, and I'm like, I don't think a six-year-old cares, to be honest. And I did get to a little bit of, I have to confess, I was slightly sarcastic. And I said, unless we say it in the original Aramaic, I'm not prepared to actually go any further with this, because I think we're just going crazy. I did actually have a conversation with both of them afterwards, and I said, I think that was really unfortunate that we had that row in front of a load of people who weren't Christians, because it made us look like we were so petty over things. We need to make sure that Pentecost is not a one-off. God has given us the ability to speak people's languages. And whilst there is the amazing and the wonderful and the supernatural, there's stories of people who, I remember... one that a lady in my church, in my first church, was telling me, she was praying for someone and she started speaking in tongues. And the person said to him, "What did you say?" you've just told me in perfect Flemish that my mother will be okay. No, I was just praising God and speaking in tongues. No, you were speaking Flemish. Now, there's all of that really wonderful, supernatural. Isn't it amazing that God can step in and make that call personal? But we've also been given the ability to speak people's languages, full stop. And you haven't got to speak a foreign language in order to speak someone's language. Part of the problem of the church is that we are desperate at times for the spectacular. We want Pentecost. We want the massive, mighty, rushing wind and the flames, because then we can go, wow, look at this. God is moving, and it's beyond all doubt. But God equips the church at that point to go and speak to everyone. He doesn't need to do it again. We just need to make sure that we are speaking. So when Simon is talking to someone that Simon talks to, perhaps he's not going to go in there with an immediate, are you aware of the soteriology of Jesus Christ? But he might say, over a beer, did you know Jesus loves you? And he might get down in the weeds with someone and just go, do you know what? This is just tough, isn't it? Let me walk with you in it. I'm not going to stand here and give you a sermon, but I am going to talk your language. Because, you know, there's another language that we completely miss. And it's the language of action. People can talk about wonderful words, and you can preach a sermon, and still no one does anything. Do you know what? Actually just getting with them, walking with them. One particular person in this church, they said to me, do you know the problem is, I've never actually just been able to sit with someone and them answer my questions. And I went, okay, well, let's do a Bible study. Just you and me, we'll do a Bible study. It's amazing, by the way. I've never had such a quick turnaround. Okay, sit down. First Bible study, I read the opening chapter of Mark. At the end of it, they said, can I get baptized? And I was like, yes, brilliant, that's done. But it was, they would say to me, and they would say if they were in the room, it's because actually they spoke my language. They just met me where I was. And they showed me by their actions that they had time for me. Now, I wish after just one Bible study, everyone would come to me and say, can I get baptized? But that's the point. And I'm going to use, is it all right, Malcolm, if I use your decision to get baptized as an example? Brilliant, that's fine. Malcolm had been weighing up and weighing up and weighing up whether he ought to get baptized for quite a long time, hadn't he? And part of it was, I don't think I'm good enough. And at the end of a sermon, I just said, and this wasn't because I knew what was wrong with Malcolm, I just said, I really feel that God wants to let you know that you're good enough. And if you wait to be good enough, you'll never go through with it. You'll never get baptized. At the end of the service, he comes down and says, Paul, I need to get baptized. Why? Because of those words. God spoke his language, spoke to him directly, and God changed the situation. Pentecost is still happening. We're just not speaking French. Or whatever language these people are speaking in here. It's just meeting people where they are.